ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Barbara Miller, and this is the Radio National Hour, coming to you from the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation in Sydney. Coming up, is Donald Trump finally coming up against the limits of his powers? This week, the administration was forced to dump plans for a slush fund to compensate MAGA loyalists. And not even an F-bomb directed at Israel's prime minister could shift the dial on peace negotiations in the Middle East. I'll be joined in a moment by Republican strategist John Feary to wrap the week. Also ahead, more than 55 million people worldwide are living with some form of dementia. And here in Australia, the disease is now our leading cause of death. As more and more loved ones disappear into this lonely void, you'll meet a young anthropologist who's travelling the world to understand the best way to help them.
I was working for a few years in a nursing home since my background is a nurse, and I asked my colleagues, would you like to live here yourself? And surprisingly, most of my colleagues said, hell no, if I get dementia, I'd rather live in a different way.
And when carrying on the family legacy means taking Dad's band on tour. Afrobeat star Shion Kuti joins me in the studio as he begins his Australian tour with Egypt 80, the band established by his pioneering father, Fela Kuti. Well, as they say, it's been a week, particularly for the US President Donald Trump, who seems to be showing some signs of strain. It began with that expletive-laden phone call to Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a sign of frustration over the quagmire in the Middle East. The president was also ordered to remove his name from the Kennedy Center. Then the administration was forced to jettison plans for a $1.8 billion US dollar slush fund intended to compensate Trump loyalists. But it hasn't been all bad. Trump-backed candidates continue to sweep the primaries, prevailing in Texas, Louisiana, and Kentucky. And overnight, we learned that his former national security adviser, John Bolton, a prominent critic of the president, has reached a deal with the U.S. Justice Department to plead guilty to a single count of retaining classified information, according to U.S. media reports. John Feary spent 15 years working in the House Republican leadership. He's now a commentator, political strategist, and author of the Feary Theory Substack. John, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thanks for having me on, Barbara.
Given what we've just outlined there, if you were going to give, points out of 10 for President Trump's week, where would you land?
I'd give him a 4. I think that many of these problems that he's faced are of his own making. You know, there's no reason to put his name on the Kennedy Center. You know, the Iran war was not necessary. He didn't have to do it right now. All these other kind of the slush fund was a mistake, and you know I don't think he needs to do all these things that are really outside the purview of what would make a successful president, which would be focusing like a laser beam on growing the economy and making sure that America is ready for the AI boom. I think that there's a lot of mistakes that this president's made. To your point on his base likes him and they want him to do well, and they don't necessarily want him to pull out of the Iran war too early, but the base is split on the wisdom of going into the war to begin with. And so ever since we've started this kind of latest adventure in the Middle East, you know, his poll ratings have gone down, and I think that he's worried about that.
And he's very keen to clinch a better deal than the one that Obama reached on Iran. Beyond opening the Strait of Hormuz, what do you think it would take for him to be able to sell any kind of Iran deal as a win and as something better than the JCPOA?
Well, the JCPOA was done, you know, without any kind of force. So it was not done with the, there was no war involved with that. And also there was no problem with the Strait of Hormuz. So, you know, we have to ensure that whatever the president does is not worse than it was. And I think that, you know, some sort of deal on securing and having better oversight over the nuclear stockpile and have some sort of agreement not to build weapons that is verifiable for a certain time period, you know, some sort of a peace agreement with the with Israel so that Hezbollah and Hamas don't continue to get engage in all of these kind of it's really kind of been a war, border war for decades. And, you know, so coming up with some sort of agreement that that finally brings that to an end, I think that could be the president could declare that a victory.
And much was made, certainly in the media, about that call between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu. Lots of expletives. It was first reported by Axios. Later, the president essentially confirmed it. He appeared, for example, on a Miranda Devine podcast. Is it helpful for Trump if this account of that call is out in the open because he wants to be being seen as being tough on Bibi Netanyahu?
Yeah, I think it does help. You know, there's been rising anti-Israel sentiment, not just with Democrats, but also with some Republicans. There's a just general sense out there that the Americans went into this war because the Israelis sold the president a bill of goods, and they made promises that never came to reality about how easy it would be to replace the regime. So I think it makes sense for him to kind of show that he's the boss, and that he's not happy with Bibi Netanyahu continuing to bomb Beirut and parts of Lebanon, and to, you know, not screw up any kind of a peace agreement with the Iranians. I mean, I think that's the biggest issue here, you know, for the president is he wants to conduct and finalize a deal with the Iranians because it's good for him domestically and it's probably good for the American economy. And, you know, not Netanyahu is kind of screwing that up by bombing Hezbollah and expanding the war zone to Beirut.
John Feary is with me on the Radio National Hour. He's a former Republican Party press secretary, now political commentator. What do you make, John, of this news overnight that John Bolton has reportedly reached a plea deal with the Justice Department over allegations he was retaining classified documents? The reporting is that he might avoid jail time, but could face a fine of $2.25 million US dollars. Is that a victory for the president?
Well, it's really more a victory for the Justice Department. You know, this investigation started under the Biden administration. And there's no doubt that Bolton had those documents and was using them for his book. And, you know, this is really not that big of a surprise. I know the president hates John Bolton, although Bolton has actually been very complimentary of the president going after the Iranian regime. So there's all kinds of strange bedfellows here. But what he did was illegal. And, you know, when you're the president and you have the ability to declassify documents, you can do that. but John Bolton didn't have that ability. And so he's going to, you know, face some penalties for it. And avoiding jail time is probably, you know, good for him. And he can afford it. You know, he makes plenty of money.
So you don't think the Bolton case sends a message to other Republican critics of Donald Trump?
Well, not unless they started organizing and taking classified documents back home and to write a book. And, you know, like I said, you can read into this that there's some sort of, you know, justice being served by the president to you know, one of his bitter critics. But he actually did break the law, so that's why he's making a deal.
Now, yet another thing that happened this week was that the president announced that Bill Pulte would become the country's acting director of national intelligence. That was after Tulsi Gabbard resigned, she said, to care for her sick husband. Hakeem Jeffries has described Bill Pulte as a malignant clown. I mean, what do you think of that comment?
Well, he's somebody who is a very successful home builder. And you might ask yourself, what does that have to do with the intelligence operation? And really not much. So that's kind of raised some eyebrows amongst Senate Republicans, especially Senate Republicans who, you know, care about intelligence matters, like Tom Cotton, and who, you know, worry about our ability to share information with our allies, especially our allies in Australia and New Zealand in the Five Eyes, who might be a little bit more reticent to share information and share intelligence if they don't trust where it's going. I think a lot of that distrust had already started under Tulsi Gabbard, who was not seen as somebody who could keep secrets. And that, you know, that has made the intelligence community, a little bit upset. And Pulte is going to be seen much more as a loyalist. He is not going to get confirmed as DNI, but he will be acting DNI for, you know, at least 200 days. And so that, you know, Trump wanted somebody in there who would do what he wanted him to do and not do what the intelligence community wanted him to do. And there's a lot of things that Trump has wanted declassified. So, you know, there's an element of the president's political base led by Roger Stone, who are absolutely delighted by this appointment because they think Bill Pulte will be very transparent when it comes to declassifying a bunch of secrets that they want declassified. On the other hand, there are some national security Republicans who don't think, Bill Pulte has any idea of what the IC is all about. And keep in mind, he's in charge of dealing with housing financing. That's his current job. And he's not giving up that job. So he's going to be dual-hatted. He's going to be running financing for housing at the same time running Director of National Intelligence, where he's supposed to be a coordinating role of all the intelligence agencies. So, you know, Trump works in mysterious ways, and this is a head scratcher for a lot of people in Washington, but for his most loyal base, conspiracy oriented base, this is fantastic.
Right. So the optics also in terms of international allies are a lot less important to him than appealing to the base in that regard. Is that your read?
It turns out to be the case. And I, you know, as you know, President Trump has diminished respect, I think you could say, for some of our international allies. And because many of in the intelligence community tried to destroy his presidency. And for example, 70 of them signed a letter saying that the Hunter Biden files were the laptop was a fraud. So there's a lot of pent up anger and distrust of the IC from the president and his allies, and this is kind of one way for the president to show his distrust of the intelligence community.
I'm Barbara Miller, and my guest is the political commentator and author of the Theory Substack, John Feary. He's joining me from the U.S. Capitol, Washington, D.C. Let's go back to that weaponization fund or anti-weaponization fund, it's been called, part of a settlement with the government over a suit brought by the president over the leaking of his tax returns back in 2018. Under the deal, as we said, $1.8 billion taxpayer dollars would have been made available to compensate allies of the president, including the convicted January 6 rioters. Why did this falter? Was it simply too much even for diehard MAGA Republicans to stomach?
No, I don't think so. I think diehard MAGA Republicans still like the fund and still wanted to, they still want compensation from the government from an overzealous Biden Justice Department that went after a lot of these folks and in many ways destroyed lives. And it wasn't just people part of J6, it was also anti-abortion protesters and people like that. And, you know, there's a sentiment on both the left and right that the government should compensate people when they do wrong and drag people through the mud for no reason. So there's some sort of accountability there. The problem with this fund is it seemed kind of sleazy. It was part of a kind of an odd lawsuit to begin with, where the president was suing his own government, even though he's president. So that was kind of weird. And there was no process. And there was just a widespread thought that if you were not a friend of Trump, you need not apply for any kind of compensation. So there was just generally distrust of the process that was created.
I wonder if, just to close off, we could turn to the primaries. They do seem to be going pretty well for Donald Trump, although we did see a MAHA, Make America Healthy Again, candidate beat a Trump pick in Iowa. What are you making of the results? What are they telling you about Trump's hold on the party and about how the midterms are likely to go?
Well, first of all, it's much better to have, if you're a Republican, it's much better to have the Trump endorsement than not have the Trump endorsement. And I think there was a couple of cases, you know, Tom Massey, John Cornyn, and Bill Cassidy. Cornyn, you know, had been a loyal soldier and had, you know, been very, very supportive of the president on most things. But after the president's, the January 6th stuff, said some negative things about the president, did not vote for impeachment, but was not seen as a loyal team player, where his more conservative counterpart was seen as MAGA all the way. I mean, Tom Massey, who was in Kentucky, got beat. He had been a thorn in the side of the president, especially when it came to the Epstein files. I was surprised because Massey had a very strong grassroots effort and raised a lot of money. But Massey was also someone that was very, very critical of Israel, and the pro-Israel lobby spent a lot of money trying to get rid of Massey, and they succeeded with Trump. So it was a pincer movement between those who were pro-Israel and those who were pro-Trump.
And what's the big picture here? Obviously, everyday voters are not in the weeds in the way that you certainly are, that I am to some extent. They, you know, they may not be reading about the anti-weaponization fund, for example. But, you know, there is, as you've highlighted, unease about the war in Iran, about rising prices. How concerned are you at this point about the Republicans' chances and prospects in the midterms?
Well, I mean, it's anytime you have a midterm election, and if it's seen as a referendum on the current president, it typically is not good news for the party that's in power. The approval ratings for President Trump are diminishing, as you said. The economy is, which was one of his strongest suits, is not, you know, doing that well. Although it's doing pretty well, the stock market's doing fine. It's just that people are really worried about the so-called affordability crisis and inflation. You know, that obviously is not good. And the war in Iran has raised gas prices, which is very problematic for a lot of voters. And then the president has been doing all kinds of goofy stuff that have nothing to do with the economy, that are very unpopular with independent voters, you know, naming the Kennedy Center after himself, building the White House ballroom, all these things that have nothing to do with it, people's daily lives, but have energized and mobilized independent voters. If you look at the poll ratings, independent voters are not very happy with this president, mostly because he's not sticking to the knitting of the economy. So, I mean, this is the real challenge for the president. He had to kind of not only motivate the base, but figure out a way. And, you know, we're not talking about a lot of congressional districts here, but there's only probably about 30 out of the 435 seats that are open in the House. Only 30 to 35 are truly competitive. And, you know, in a wave election, they could lose all 35 and the Democrats would have control. And now there's increasing worry from the Republican side of the Senate flipping. I think that's less likely than other people. But, you know, if the trend lines keep going down, if the president can't figure out a way to get out of this Iran war, you know, it could be bad news for the Republicans.
Yeah, bad news for the world and for Donald Trump's political fortunes, for sure. John, thank you so much for joining me.
All right, Barbara. Thank you.
John Feary is a former Republican press secretary, now political strategist and author of the Feary Theory Substack. Coming up, like father, like son, Nigerian musician Shiankuti is continuing the family business, leading the band Egypt 80, established by Afrobeat pioneer and political firebrand Fela Kuti.
Hello, it's Hamish McDonald.
And I'm Geraldine Duke.
Our AUKUS nuclear submarine deal is now in question. We were meant to get some new, some used. Now we're getting all used submarines.
The government says it's the deal we always wanted.
But have we been sold a lemon?
Is it time to ditch the deal and go back to the French?
That's coming up at 11 a.m. and again 9 p.m. on ABC Radio National.
Or any time on ABC Listen.
At the age of 21, Ton Tubesh, a nurse, moved into a new place. It was a share house of sorts, but his flatmates weren't fellow uni students. They were dementia patients. Ton moved into the closed ward of a nursing home in his home country of the Netherlands. After working in the industry, he wanted to see for himself what life for a dementia patient was like. And after living there for 3.5 years, he wanted to see how the quality of life of people living with dementia could be improved. So, incredibly, he decided to travel around the world looking at how other countries treated their dementia patients, making a documentary about it along the way with director Jonathan de Jong. It's called Human Forever. At the moment, more than 55 million people are living with some form of dementia worldwide. And here in Australia, dementia is now our leading cause of death. Ton and Jonathan are in Australia for the International Dementia Conference and touring screenings of their film Human Forever around Australia. Fran spoke to Ton and Jonathan earlier.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is quite a project. Ton, you moved into a nursing home at the age of 21?
21, yes.
That's a very unusual thing for a 21-year-old to do. Why did you do that? Why didn't you just go visit people?
Well, I was working for a few years in a nursing home since my background is a nurse, and I asked my colleagues, would you like to live here yourself? And surprisingly, most of my colleagues said, hell no, if I get dementia, I'd rather live in a different way. One person said, I'd rather stay in a house with my daughter or my son, or I get a house together with friends, or I don't want to live. But no one was dreaming about the future in the nursing home. So since I was working there and it constantly felt like I entered this a surreal nobody's land, a place where only people with dementia were living, I wanted to live there myself to experience how can we improve the system which we have created by good intentions, but only good intentions don't lead to quality of life. And apart from that, I wanted to listen to people living with dementia. So first-hand experience from living together with dementia, because we very often see dementia as a care problem, but it is a societal issue. This is a message for all of us.
Tell me what it was like in the home. Did you live as the residents lived? Did you sleep in the same sort of rooms that they did? Did you eat the same food?
I was living on the closed ward, so my room was 21 square meters with a system ceiling. I had a shared bathroom with my housemates, and I only had the big privilege to go outside. So I was still able to maintain the relationships with my friends, to have this reciprocity towards society. On the one hand, it was beautiful to constantly feel and experience that people living with dementia are human beings like you and me. People with a need to be seen, to be heard, people who want to belong. And on the other hand, it also was very painful, because it is in many ways a system which is so often focused on safety and on control. So if it is, for instance, above 30 degrees, you can't go outside because of the heat protocol. And the fact that we were living on the closed wards tells a lot about the fact that we create collective safety instead of being focused on the individual's quality of life. And this has to change so badly.
Jonathan, some of the vignettes at the start of the film are incredibly sad. Mm-hmm. You know, one woman in the home that Ton is living with says, I'm no longer any use whatsoever. Mm. And another is terribly upset and she says she's scared. It's hard to watch. Mm-hmm. How did you deal with watching this as the director, through the lens, in a sense?
Yeah, like, of course, for the urgency, we really want to show also the impact, what it's like to live in a nursing home. And on the other hand, this is also a part of life. Mm. Like, normal life can also be sad. And the easiest thing to make was a sad film around dementia. But if we want to change our narrative, if we want to change the future, we should really embrace all the hopeful initiatives that are there around the world. So that's why, of course, we a lot of space for people who are really reflecting on, my life isn't worth anymore. And I think that's a core feeling that no one should have in the world.
You're listening to Radio National Hour. My guests are filmmaker Jonathan De Jong and Tone Tubesch. And they're talking about their documentary, Human Forever, which looks at care and treatment for people with dementia in different models around the world in different countries. So you two decided to travel around the world. What did you find, Tone? How broad were the different approaches to aging and dementia?
There are so many different ways to take care of people living with dementia. And what I found the most inspiring were the examples where the community had a very central role in taking care of people. So we were, for instance, in South Africa. In South Africa, they, in many places, they don't have a care system as we know. The community had a different role. Taking care of each other was not seen as a burden, but sometimes also as something you want to do because it's something you get energy back from. I also found Moldova quite inspiring. It's in east of Europe because it's a country where they don't have a lot of money. And we often, if we want to improve care systems, we think we need more money. But it is not always about the amount of money. It's about what do we do with the money we have? What are the rhetorics in our system?
Yeah, let's talk about Moldova because it is not, as you say, it's not a very rich system.
No.
There's not a lot of money spent there by the looks of it. You know, people are inside in bars on the balconies.
You see people standing outside in steel places. They can't go outside. But at the same time, the poverty of our wealth is that we often believe that if a building looks nice, that life could be meaningful as well.
And the reality in Moldova is they don't have dedicated dementia wards for people. The people with dementia are cared for in a psychiatric facility. And as I say, it's not lush in there.
And I absolutely don't say that dementia is psychiatry, but what you did see in that home is that people with all different needs were living together. So people had the possibility to help each other. And thinking back of the way I was living for 3.5 years with my housemates with dementia, beautiful people like Ott, Ellie, Eugenie, but all people with dementia. All people with the same certain needs.
With the same label, in a sense.
Exactly. So you are excluded based on your diagnosis. And that's also why I so strongly believe that we need more social forms of living. So places where your dementia is not the only entrance ticket to be allowed to live somewhere.
It's interesting, though, that you found that positive within that Moldovan system because, as I say, on the face of it, it looks impoverished. But the comments from the head of the system, the person who runs the system, were very positive. And what was really noticeable to me as I watched it was there were people of all different generations. I mean, they were in a psych hospital, so there was young people and older people and fitter people and as you say, people with different labels living together. Yeah. Do you think that cross-generational thing is something that is a positive?
Absolutely. Cross-generational, sometimes we also call it intergenerational, it can be of a really big value, but only if it is not seen as an instrument. I didn't start living in a nursing home because of an intergenerational project, because what we often do then is that we quantify living together. So we say to young people, you can live here, but in exchange, you have to do 20 hours of volunteer work a month. Living together is also sitting next to each other in the same room without speaking to each other, but having a feeling of connection. And that is what I daily experience with my housemates. It's about the feeling of security instead of entertaining people with dementia.
And did you observe that there were some models that facilitated that more too? I mean, you went to Denmark and Belgium, they've got beautifully designed facilities, Jonathan. How important are the surroundings, if you like, the aesthetic of the places?
It is really important because, like the nursing homes that we have in the Netherlands, the majority of them, they don't feel like a home. And you can see it because you have to walk through many doors to come to your room. They all look the same, with the same furniture, with the same plants, often plastic plants. And what we heard from people who are experiencing life with dementia is that they want to have a normal life as possible. So what we also saw in the Netherlands on the care farm, you couldn't tell the difference who was visiting and who was living there. And it was just because they say, like, we accept some risks because we stand for a good quality of life. And if we accept a good quality of life, then we all have to also accept the risks that come with it. So you can go outside. We have normal plants. We have normal carpets. Like a lively environment creates lively human beings. And that's really important also for us to really facilitate the wishes of the people themselves.
And Tone, how much did you notice that? And did you get that sense from the people that they felt like they were at home? I noticed that some of these places in the Scandinavian countries had pets. People had chores to do. They were cutting up their veggies for dinner. They could leave when they wanted to, I think. Does that make a big difference?
Absolutely. If we organize care homes as places being focused on having zero risks, then life will be zero as well. So life comes with risks. So a lively environment leads to lively people. I saw a man standing over a dog, stepping over a dog, a real dog. And the first thing I thought is, oh my God, if that person falls, we have a fall protocol.
That's a trip hazard.
But what did I see? Because he was stepping over the dog, he was still able to keep his muscles. So it's always about use it or lose it.
You're listening to Radio National Hour. My guests are filmmaker Jonathan De Jong and dementia advocate, I guess I call you, Tone Tebesh, talking about their documentary Human Forever, which looks at how we can better care for people living with dementia. And to do this, they've literally travelled around the world filming different systems. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, family care aspect is deeply cultural. You know, it's very important cultural aspects. I think sometimes in the West, we automatically look towards European care models or Scandinavian care models and think, oh, they're going to be better. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about some very different societies. You mentioned South Africa earlier. In South Africa, you visit two homes where the family is looking after the person with dementia. Here's one of their stories.
And I told her, that's why the boys is killing the old people. They say, yes, they are witches because they talk alone. It's not witches. It's about, I think it's something in the big people.
So you are afraid that your mom got killed because boys are thinking in mm-hmm. the streets that she is
a witch.
Yeah.
I know. Where in Stagspruit, they burn some old lady. They say she's a witch, but she wasn't a witch, but she was burned dead. And when she runs away, they beat her in the fire. She must burn dead, and she burned dead in her house.
Oh.
Yes, something bad happened with old people. So that's why you must have a good care, take a good care after your mom.
So the care for your mom is also a choice between life and death?
Yes.
I found that story very frightening, really, because, you know, it goes to cultural beliefs. And it was violent, and someone who's with dementia who might be talking to themselves or ranting at the sky is perceived as a witch. I wonder why you decided to add it into the documentary, Jonathan.
Yes, because it's a story that's quite well known, also in Africa and in multiple countries. And I wanted to show that not knowing anything about dementia is not necessarily a bad thing, but it can be a bad thing if there are cultural interpretations about something that isn't true. So I think it's really important to create awareness around dementia, how we can treat people with dementia, how we can facilitate their wishes. So we have to create awareness. That's why I showed also this clip, because we don't want people to get beaten up or killed. But on the other hand, we shouldn't label people too much, because that's what we do in a Western society. We give them a label with dementia and we exclude them from society as well. So it's not about excluding them. It's about creating awareness and then start listening to people with dementia themselves rather than organizing based on our beliefs what's best for them.
And in stark contrast, you also feature the South Korean model. And I thought this was really interesting. South Korea has a rapidly aging population, as we do here in Australia, but they have an active dementia prevention model, and dementia is a national priority. What difference does this make?
It makes a huge difference because people get a call from the government that they could do some tests to check their risk on getting dementia. And by changing the lifestyle, a certain type of dementia and a certain type of development, it could prevent with 40%. At the moment of diagnosis, you are too late. But it starts from a younger age, for instance, 55, 65. And it's about changing your lifestyle based on the idea what's good for your heart, it's good for your brain. And they have a model with a few principles, for instance, what you're eating, but also very important, the social connections we have. It's so important to stay socially connected to people around you, to keep on doing new things, to keep on developing. And what we saw in South Korea was very interesting and intriguing as well, because people were so enthusiastic about it, and it had a national priority. And this is what dementia has to be. It has to be a national priority, not because it's a leading cause of death. What's more painful is the fact that dementia can be a social death.
Yeah. And just finally, Tone, and congratulations on the doco. And I know it's, Jonathan, congratulations to you. I think it's been released in 26 countries. It's won a whole lot of awards. I think it's the Netherlands' number one ever documentary. So it's clearly struck a chord. And I think for so many of us, it reveals how nervous we are too about this disease, I think.
It's because it's a narrative of hope. And so often, speaking about dementia, we speak about a narrative of losing, a total loss of identity.
The film is not an attack on the current healthcare system. It's really opening up. It's a spark for a new dialogue on how we can change within the system. This film really shows how we can change already within the system if we embrace all the positive initiatives around the world. And those together create a different narrative. And that narrative, that hopeful narrative, is really what people are really looking for in their lives, because hope makes people want to live.
Well, congratulations. It's full of hope and heart, this film. So thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much.
That was dementia activist John Tulbisch and filmmaker Jonathan de Jong. And you can catch their film, Human Forever, at screenings around Australia from now until June the 13th. You can also check out their book of the same title at their website, human-forever.com. You're listening to the Radio National Hour. When the Nigerian musical icon and pioneer of the Afrobeat genre, Fela Kuti, passed away in 1997, it was his youngest son, Seun, who took up the mantle, picking up the saxophone and fronting his father's ensemble, Egypt 80, at the age of just 14. Since then, he's continued his father's legacy, creating music to uplift listeners and call for social and political change in Nigeria and beyond. Seun and Egypt 80 are here in Australia, and I'm very pleased to say they join me in the studio. Seun, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thanks for having me, Barbara. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. Now, it can't really be overstated, can it, how important your father was to Nigeria, Nigerians, and the music world more broadly. What was it like growing up with Fela Kuti as your dad?
You know, and this is a testament to the man's humanity and just realness. Like, growing up with my dad, I didn't even know my dad was famous until I started going to school and meeting other people who were fascinated by the fact that I was his son. You know, and that's how I knew my dad was famous. Not because of the way he lived at home or, you know, or anything like that. I never spoke about his fame, you know.
and yet you were opening for him at a very young age. I believe you began opening for Egypt 80 at the age of 8. What was that like?
This was also because, you know, we're always around the music. And my dad made it like it was almost a duty for him. Like, he made sure we saw every show. We went on most of the tours, you know, were on the road with him, you know, and I was just really inspired by what I saw going on. So I said to my dad, I would love to perform, you know. I said, can you perform? What can you do? I said, I can sing, you know. So I sang one of his songs. I said, okay, we rehearse with the band, I will find a way to get you playing, you know. And that's the beginning for me, you know. This was just because I was really fascinated by the man and the band, you know, and the entirety of what was happening around me.
And then we, as we said, your father died when you were still just a young teenager. When you took over his musical legacy, was that a way of dealing with your grief?
Well, no, I wouldn't say. It was a way of doing something for my dad also, you know. But I think my grief was, I grieved in a very different way. I did not escape. I try and immerse myself in my father's music or in my father's band. I'd always been in the band, you know. For us, after Fela's passing, you know, to K keep his band alive was just, you know, like, so when people say take over as well, like, I didn't, you know, this is not what happened. I'd always been in the band. And as a group, we just really wanted to keep that part of his legacy alive as well. You know, I never knew it was going to be my career, you know. It was just what I wanted to do at that time in memory of my father, you know, to do something, because he was a guy that did so much for me when we were together, while he was alive, you know. So I was just like, oh, this is something cool to do for him.
And was
Let's keep playing.
Was it a question of continuing his legacy, as it were, or did you want to put your own stamp on the music that Egypt 80 was making?
Well, as I said, back then, you know, there was no ulterior motives. I was a kid. I was just having fun. I wasn't thinking, this is my career. You know, and even if I wanted to be a musician back then, I wanted to be a rapper, you know. I was just classically trained. I could play instruments, so I could fit in the Egypt 80, you know. I had to grow up, become an adult, and understand truly the ideology, the struggle, and the consciousness with the liberating theology that Afrobeat was trying to, or was impacting on the world, for me to understand that aspect of being an Afrobeat performer or an Afrobeat artist, you know. That came with its own sense of growing up and belonging, you know. That was separate from what I was doing, you know, when I was 14 with the band and, you know.
So how would you describe the music now compared to that of your father, Fela Kuti? What's the twist that you bring?
Well, first and foremost, you know, I think we should just straight up the gates say people shouldn't compare art. You know, art is not for comparison. You know, we do it in the world today. Everybody does it because we are sold in, we live in a world where everybody's in competition. So everything becomes like sports statistics, you know, but artistry is so individual. It is so subjective as well. Comparing artists and art, you know, I don't think it's healthy. But that being said, you know, my music, you know, is a projection of who I am as a person. As a human, you know, we give thanks to my father as the great ancestor that was able to interpret this genre in a way that we African people and globally, the global audience too, can enjoy. But as his sons, because my brother too plays, I play, we have able to put our mark on it as who we are. You know, my music is a reflection of who I am. And that's the best way I can compare it.
And your brother is Femi Kuti.
Yeah.
Do you guys ever play together?
A lot. We do a lot of shows back home, yeah.
And look, this is a question that will be so obvious to you, but you play in the Afrobeat genre, and that's different to the Afrobeats genre. Tell us a little bit, if you could, about that distinction.
Afrobeat is political music for African liberation, and Afrobeat is pop music for African enjoyment. Both are valid. So I don't want you to think, you know, liberation art is in a way better or more noble than just art for entertainment's sake. I think both forms of artistry have their space in human consciousness and in the human psyche. And we need both, you know, for different moments that we experience in life, for different experiences. Yeah.
On the Radio National Hour, Sheyun Kuti is with me, and do stay with us. His band Egypt 80 is going to be playing with us shortly. You were born in Nigeria. Are you still living there?
Yeah.
And how do you feel the country is going? President Bola Ahmed Tinubu has been in power since 2023, and his party, the All Progressives Congress, in power since 2015, but he may face a strong challenge at the next election. Do you feel progress is being made in Nigeria?
I don't think that if we are class conscious in Nigeria, or as Africans, we understand that the ruling class do not really face any challenges when they go to the polls. At least not yet in my country, because we are just beginning to build parties that represent the working people. You know, all the parties that exist in our country are elitist parties. President Bola Ahmed Tinubu's All People's Congress being one of those elitist parties that just look to replace one rich person with another rich person from the same class to operate the same systems, to commit the same atrocities against the people, you know. So we're looking forward to a real competition in the face of our national elections, where the working class and the poor people can truly have their own representation to wrestle power away from the elites. I don't like to call them elites because they don't really compete at the top. So I call them the ruling class of our country, you know. Yeah.
And your father also had a political party, the Movement of the People, which I think you took over. Is politics something you might get into in any kind of full-time capacity?
Oh, I am already in politics, you know, in full-time capacity as the chairman of the Movement of the People. You know, I think as African people, we truly need to dedicate ourselves to the development of our continent. There's no such thing as being non-political. Because I say to other artists, because a lot of artists use that caveat to escape. Oh, I'm just an artist. I don't want to be political. And I said that in itself, you know, saying you're not political is a political statement, you know. So we just need, as African people, not just musicians, you know, as lawyers, as doctors, engineers, accountants, teachers, journalists, all of us that have talent and gifts and skills must understand that our nation cannot develop devoid of its own national talent. We all have to be willing to sacrifice and contribute to that which we want to see, you know, in our land.
And how big a movement is the party, the Movement of the People?
Oh, well, our party is quite big. I think the government is very scared of our movement. That's why they are making it very difficult for us to register as a political party. But we are in court with the government right now to have our party officially recognized in the country, so we can begin to do the work that we do, the liberation work necessary to bring people out of this bondage.
So at the moment, you couldn't put forward candidates in elections?
Yes, no, we can't, because they are really blocking. They're scared.
And do you think that message, a revolutionary message which runs through your music, is it tailored? Well, it's obviously focused on Nigeria, but do you think there's a broader message?
No, for me, my message is primarily for Nigerian people, but it's also, I also have a global aspect to it, you know, as one that believes in the class struggle, you know, the global class struggle of the working class against the global elites and their agenda for humanity, you know, the continual domination of both humanity and nature, the exploitation, the reckless waste that we experience in the face of so much that people can't even afford to eat, send their children to school, pay medical bills. And this is a global thing. And I have a class message for class solidarity globally, that as long as we all want a healthy planet, you know, and healthy children, and to live a life with dignity, that we can also unite around that ideology, you know, to build a global movement, you know, that stands for the working people, you know, of this world.
And in your fight for that cause, where do you draw hope in current global events?
Well, I think hope is for, I have will, let me put it that way. So I don't do the hope game. You know, I have will, so I will do what I can. I am not hoping for the best. I want to do what I can, you know, and I will do what I can. And I think if we all do what we can and will ourselves to do that, you know, hoping is like thinking, oh, somebody somewhere is going to fix it, or, oh, it's going to, nah. We're not trying to hope, because the solutions to the issues that face humanity and nature is one that needs our attention, our engagement, you know, not about abstract hope or thinking.
And you're going to play a song called Problems now. Tell us a little bit about that one.
This song is truly inspired by my own experience of doing liberation work. You know, like, there's no aspect of this world that is not a struggle, that is calm. There's nobody in this world, there's no profession that is not under attack. You know, you're a doctor, you're a lawyer, civilian, whatever, even police officers, you know, that defend this system, you know, have to struggle through this system. You know, that everything we experience, you know, anything we choose, every decision we make in this age of social media, you know, everything we choose to be, gay, straight, everything, there's a problem with it. You can't be right. You can't, you know, just be allowed to be anymore. You know, there's a line drawn in every facet of human existence today that is quite combative, that is me or them, you know, that we as humanity cannot really have conversations anymore and just be allowed to experience life from our own perspective, you know. There's a battle line for everything that anybody wants to do, be, every experience. We all have to know what 10,000 people think about us at once, you know. So that's what the song is about, you know, the chaos of being alive today.
Wow, we look forward to immersing ourselves in it. Thank you, Sheon, so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
That was Sheon Kuti with Egypt 80, and you can see them as part of the Rising Festival this evening at Hammer Hall in Melbourne. If you're in Sydney, they'll be playing a free concert as part of Vivid tomorrow evening. And that's it from the show for this week. You can find any of our interviews on ABC Listen. Thanks so much to the team, producers Grace Stranger, Claire O'Halloran and Flint Duxfield, and executive producer Katie Heyman. To see us into the weekend, let's have a listen to Problems by Sheon Kuti and Egypt 80.
Mo fema,
jese ye dada.
Mo dema,
jese ye dada.
Mo nima,
jese ye dada.
Mo dema,
jese ye dada.
Mo lati,
jese ye dada.
Mo dema, 1, 2, 3, 4.
I got skill distress. I won't smoke no more, and I'll smoke no less. I can't kill myself. I got skill distress. You be doctor, you be lawyer, laborer, lecturer, politician, officer, civilian, hustler. Nothing easy for the people. Everything now puzzle. Hard like Sudoku. And everybody just a hustle. Nothing easy for the people. Everything now puzzle. Like Sudoku, but everybody said they are. So I won't smoke no more, and I'll smoke no less. I can't kill myself, I got skill distress. I won't smoke no more, and I'll smoke no less. I can't kill myself, I got skill distress. You left, you right, you run, you fight, you love, you hate, you gay, you straight. Nothing makes sense, everything is a mess. Read your boss my brain, and the thing they pay. I see nothing makes sense, everything is a mess. Read your boss my brain, and the thing they are. So I won't smoke no more, and I
smoke no less. I can't kill myself, I got skill distress. I won't smoke no more.